back up. Back up. And so I'll turn on this little recorder too.
Uploading now?
Excellent. Oh, come on, where's the on switch? I have used this device successfully in the past, but I always forget how to turn it on, and sometimes the battery's off, which also makes it trickier.
You want us to have a look for you?
No, I'll use this. Boot up times are... Okay. Record, and... Am I recording? How can I tell if I'm recording? Oh, click. All right, so I'm using my camera to record. Okay, so I think I'm pretty much set here. So I'm going to pop back over to the Illuminate thing. Oh, okay. We are, okay.
I'm at slide 40.
You're at slide 40, so we've got about 60 or 80 to go. Oh, I'm kidding. So let me just check. Illuminate room, still here? Still hear me? Yes. Okay. I'm just going to slide that up a wee bit. No, I can't move that. That figures. Let's unlock the layout so that we can.
You should see it now.
And I don't see it. It's going to take a few seconds. So there's the chat room. Again, if you're in the room on the Illuminate, feel free to take part in the chat. And, the title of this session is something to do with open education. I'll know what it is as soon as I get the slides up. No, I'm just kidding. Open education, projects, and potential. Let me just explain that opening screen while we're waiting for the slides to load into the Illuminate area. They're there for you. Ah, there they are for me. Life is good.
Yeah.
So there's probably a way to maximize that. Oh, but I don't want to cover the conversation. See, what I've learned over the years is if you want to pull something like this off, what you really need is several screens and several projectors. But, you know, it was a bit much to ask for all of that. So we're started anyways. We're a few minutes late. Oh, and you would like to introduce... Please go ahead.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I didn't
mean to. That's okay. I have the pleasure of introducing Stephen Downs, and that's kind of one of the perks of being in the office chair. You get the speakers that you really want. So it's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for coming. I first started following your work when I became a blogger. So,
can you speak into the mic?
Oh, okay. When I first started blogging, that's when I started to follow your work. And Stephen's from the National Research Council of Canada. He's a teacher of open online courses as well as an interest in open education. He's working on the Personal Learning Environment Project that I hope he'll share with us, and the author of OL Daily. So we're grateful that you're here. Thank you.
Thank you. It's kind of funny because I can hear your voice on one of the Illuminate sessions there.
Sorry, yeah. I'm muted.
No, that's fine. It's funny. And as long as there's no feedback, it's fine. If there's feedback, it's less than fine. Now, this picture. This is a bird sanctuary in a place called Sackville, New Brunswick. It's about half an hour down the road from me, a nice little university town. And I wanted to use this image to introduce this talk, because first of all, it's an open image. Anybody can use this image. I took this image with my own camera, and I posted it online, and I licensed it such that anybody can use this image without royalties or even asking me for permission or anything like that. So it's a classic example of an open educational resource, LensCap. But the bird sanctuary itself is an open educational resource, isn't it? Because it's got the nice path here through the birch trees, and you can't really see, but there's pond on either side of the trees, and there's ducks and geese and frogs, and, well, there weren't any frogs when I went because it was like November, but you know what I mean? And people take all this time and effort to set up these things, these are open educational resources. And the very spirit that motivates the creation of a bird sanctuary and a walkway where anybody in the town or city or nearby or tourists or whoever can just walk through at their own will, that very spirit is the spirit that motivates online learning. And people sometimes talk, or that motivates open educational resources. People sometimes talk about the cost. The cost of that one park is probably greater than the entire amount of money spent in this country on open educational resources. So, you know, there's cost and there's cost. I am completely in support of parks like this, and in that same breath, in support of open educational resources. This is the first of two talks that I'm doing today. I mean, it's funny, you know, because you do two talks in one day, there's always the bad talk and the good talk. This is the bad talk. No. But they form two parts of a pair. So this is the how and what of open educational resources. And the second talk, which I'll do this afternoon, is the why and what you do with them. So, and that's really important, because I'm going to talk a lot, and you'll come out of here with all kinds of ideas about, oh yeah, there's this, and etc. And you'll be scratching your head, but why do I care? The second talk is the why do I care part. But still, the talks are independent, self-sustaining entities. No, really. Okay, let's see how this works now. So, I want to begin by talking briefly about a course that George Siemens and I are offering online. It's called Connectivism and Connective Knowledge. This setup here with the Illuminate is part of that course. So what we've done is we simply linked this presentation into that course. This diagram here, this is from last year's CCK 08 course. This is a diagram that was created by a student. This is a map of the course. And what you should notice right off the bat is it does not look at all like the courses that you do in a learning management system or in your classroom or anything like that. Like, where are the chapters? You know, where's the course outline? Where, you know, and what's worse is all of this stuff is not located on any single server. It's all over the place. And this is just the stuff that George and I did. And then there's an explosion of resources around this, which I won't be able to get to talk about a whole lot in this talk at all, that were created by the students. This is a model of open learning. And this is kind of the what and the how. There's the link down there, downs.ca/presentation/210, will take you to a presentation describing that course in detail. You don't need to remember any of this stuff. All of these slides will be available on my website, downs.ca, probably this evening sometime, as well as the audio recording of this, and hopefully the Illuminate recording, if everything has gone well. So those of you who are in the chat room, because I'm in front of the room talking to an audience, I'm not actually seeing the chat. So, because I just can't multitask that much. Comment?
Could you repeat how to access the chat room on the website?
Yes. Go to connect.downs.ca and...
there's a link to an Illuminate session.
Yeah, there's a link that says go to today's edition of The Daily.
Okay.
And then the first link in The Daily is the link to this session. So, and so, you know, you're going here and then over to here and then down to here, which will link you down to here, is basically how that's working. What's neat about the Connectivism and Connective Knowledge course is mostly we didn't prepare stuff for it. We just gathered stuff from all over the place and put it into this ridiculous scattered environment. And the reason why we put it into a ridiculous scattered environment instead of into a nice, neat, organized environment is that people are able to come into the course and graze. They find what they're interested in, pursue their own paths, their own interests, And the communication and the collaboration in the course occurs when people present their individual perspectives. Each perspective of the course is different, right? Because they're all looking at different resources. And that creates something new in the chat room and the discussion area. Here's another way of looking at that same structure, where the center, that's me, or that's you, or that's any individual person, and then the various resources are scattered all around. And the center, which is me, connects to these various resources in various places online. 43 things for a to-do list, Flickr for photos, a learning management system, a blogging site, whatever. This talk, in that context, is about finding the materials to populate a system like this. And when I say finding the materials to populate a system like this, what I mean is the whole infrastructure of what have come to be called open educational resources. Now, people use that word narrowly, people use that word broadly. I use that word very broadly. As far as I'm concerned, an open educational resource is anything that is open, but is also an educational resource. Well, that was really bad. let's try maybe something a little bit more precise. First of all, it's got to be open. It's got to be available at no cost to the consumer or user of the resource. To me, again, I interpret that very broadly. No fees, no subscriptions, no tuitions, no registrations, no obligations, etc. Now, it's one thing for something to be free. It's another thing for something to be free and you have to fill out a subscription form to get it, right? There have been, in this morning, two such things already. All of Ian Juke's stuff is free, but you have to sign in to get it. Not quite free. Or the Adobe thing, you get free software if you fill out a little petition form that they will send to the government. There's free and there's free. As far as I'm concerned, and this is me, your variation of free might vary, right? Free means no cost, no subscriptions, no tuitions, etc. Free also can be interpreted very broadly. And I interpret it very broadly. Free isn't just being able to see the thing. That's one part of free. Freedom, there are various kinds of freedoms. Freedom to access the resource, freedom to copy the resource, freedom to modify the resource, freedom to redistribute the resource. Because, you know, especially in our kind of environment, if all you can do is look at something, it's not really very useful. There was other various museums. I don't need to pick on any one of them. But there was one of the museums in New York said, we've got these great free resources online. You can come down and look at our virtual museum. You go to their virtual museum. All you can do is look at their flash-rendered version of their artwork. That's it. Can't copy it, can't share it, can't put little mustaches on them. That's not free. You can look at it, but it's not free, right? In the world of open educational resources, there can be some conditions attached that are generally accepted in the community. Attribution, you have to credit the author of the resource. Share alike, if you make it for free to someone else, then someone else has to make it for free to the next person. Non-commercial, that's something I put on my resources. If a non-commercial license is attached, then you can't use it to, you can't turn around and sell it, right? No modify artists sometimes do this. Editorial writers sometimes do this in order to ensure the integrity of the work. There have been discussions about an educational condition. Right now, there is no license extant for that, and that's actually a good thing. So, that's open educational resources in outline. Free and not like in kittens. You just never know what you're going to see in the chat area. I tell you, it's a different world. What resources? Not just courseware. And this is where people kind of get off the rails when you're talking about open educational resources, because they must mean curricula, curricular materials, tests or whatever, course outlines, teaching materials. From my perspective, this can be any kind of content, but not just content, but also tools, applications that help you do things, also capacity. One of the things, they have their Adobe lobby. My lobby, the thing I'm trying to get government to do, is not to buy Adobe licenses, but to make the capacity to have things like this open classroom available online for all teachers in the country. That's the sort of thing I'd like to see. Or free blogging systems for all teachers, or free e-portfolio systems for all teachers, but not the Adobe one. Never mind. I don't need to go there. Just bugs me. Yeah, because, no. If it was just a presentation and they were just like, okay, here's our product, take a look, and if you like it, etc. But they're exchanging a product for a vote, right? And then they take these votes, and that's what bugs me. Okay, enough. Free means more than just cost as well. We need to consider the usability of the resource. Free resources that you cannot use are not very useful. That one should go into the Tautology of the Week award. They need to be durable in the sense that, you know, they're not simply fleeting. They're not simply access to a live event and then it's gone tomorrow and you can never see it again. Accessible for people who have accessibility issues. A resource is not free if it is not accessible, fairly self-evidently. And effective in the sense that the resource ought to do what you want it to do. Getting software for free that turns out to be defective, like that WordStar stuff, what software, never mind. I've had a lifelong issue with WordStar. So we want to think of free not just in the sense of free as in beer, as in free beer, but free, as Richard Stallman says, as in freedom. Freedom to use the resource, freedom to access the resource, freedom to do what we want with the resource. And this is where this is going to shade over to the talk this afternoon. It's not simply about being a passive consumer of the resource. You can be a passive consumer of free stuff and not be free. If you think about it, in countries that are not free, the propaganda is free, which makes sense because it wouldn't be very effective otherwise. But that's not freedom. For freedom to operate in the sphere of educational resources and resources generally, you have to be able to do more than just consume the resource. You have to have the capacity to work with, create, and propagate or send forward the resource. And so all of these things come into play. Nope, that arrow just cheat is not working here. Okay. The neat thing, I think it's a neat thing, that has been done in recent years in order to propagate free resources is the creation of various free resourcing licenses. And basically what these licenses are is a way for the content owner to declare to anyone who's accessing the resource that this is a free resource. Now this is necessary because, I forget when it was, the 70s or something like that, our copyright system kind of flip-flopped, and it came to be the case that the default licensing condition for any resource whatsoever is that it is copyright. So if you do not know what license attaches to the resource, then you need to assume, and this is in effect in Canada, the United States, and pretty much everywhere, you need to assume that all rights are reserved. In other words, the resource is fully copyright to whoever created or owns the resource. So, it's kind of weird, but what we need to do in today's society, in order to make a resource free is to explicitly declare that it is free. It used to be you could just give it away, it became free. But now you have to actually say that it's free. If you don't say it's free, it's not free. Now, the philosopher in me, who would have guessed there's a philosopher in me? The philosopher in me says, that's completely backwards, right? We've made private ownership of ideas and content the norm. But there's not much the philosopher in me can do about it. So the pragmatist in me says, okay, we've got to go along with these licensing schemes. By far and away, the most prevalent of these is the Creative Commons licensing scheme. And this is a mechanism for making everything, including your head, free. These symbols represent the different conditions that I mentioned earlier. Attribution license, share alike license, non-commercial license, and no derivatives. Is that no derivatives? Or maybe this is share alike and this is no... Anyhow, those little symbols represent the different licenses. And the way Creative Commons works is you can go to their site and custom build a license. They'll ask you, do you want to make sure there's attribution? Do you want to allow commercial use, etc.? And then you answer these questions and it generates a license. And basically, it's, you know, it's a matrix of possible licenses that you can have. Me, as I said, I use attribution, share alike, non-commercial. Attribution, now strictly speaking, attribution is no longer required. All Creative Commons licenses now require attribution. But I'm a stick in the mud. My license was like from the previous century. So, well, maybe not that long ago, but you know what I mean. It's old. So I still have attribution on my license because I want credit for my work because, well, I'm like that. Share alike because I want people to use the same licensing if they use my work. I want them to pass it on in the same way. Non-commercial, and this is an issue that I've had with other people over the years. I insist on non-commercial. A lot of the open education resource sites insist on non-commercial. And the reason for that is I interpret commercial use of a resource to be essentially making money by blocking access to the resource. So I don't want that to happen. I want to make sure that my resource is always freely available. Therefore, I ask that people not charge money for access to my resource. That's my interpretation of this. Other people have different interpretations. It's an issue of some contention. Creative Commons finesses that issue by allowing people to choose. And so in licensing of your own work, you too have the capacity to choose to allow commercial or non-commercial use. It's pretty smart idea, actually. There's another older type of open content license called the GNU. Richard Stallman tells me it's GNU. So, okay, it's GNU, even though it should be new, but never mind. Free documentation license. GNU's not Unix, is the type of license that was applied to the original open source operating systems. It is an open license for software. And the reasoning here was that the documentation that accompanied that open source, or as Richard Stallman would say, free software, should also be free. And so he developed something called the GNU Free Documentation License. It's very similar to Creative Commons and is being replaced by Creative Commons, but certainly for historical purposes, you should know that this exists. One of the key conditions that it has that Creative Commons doesn't have, and I think personally that this is a huge weakness in Creative Commons, and, bracket, a big part of the reason why I insist on a non-commercial license on my stuff, no proprietary formats or DRM. If you think about it, right, you can have Creative Commons licensed content, and if you stick it in an Amazon Kindle, nobody can get at it. Right? That's perfectly legitimate under Creative Commons, the GFDL would make that contrary to the license. And just as a side, that's what Amazon or Barnes & Noble or whoever, that's what they're doing. They're going to take this free content and put it into a proprietary platform. And eventually, the only way you'll be able to get at this free content is to buy their platform and actually pay for the content, even though it's free. Just bugs me. David Wiley, if you don't know him, look him up, has been a pioneer in the field of open educational resources. He developed his own license, the Open Publication License. It's kind of like a slimmed down Creative Commons. Notice there's no non-commercial condition there. Also notice the there's no concern about proprietary formats. We've had discussions on and off about all of this over the years. This license is now, what's the word for it? Depreciated. You won't find this license used, but again, for historical purposes, it was very important in its time. One of the things that Dave Wiley points out is the issues that arise when you mix licenses, and this really ties into the connectivism course in a very tight way. Here's the problem. You have a resource that's commercial, or that allows commercial use. You have a resource, say it's one of my photos, attribution, share alike, non-commercial. What happens if you take my photo and put it into this document? What licensing goes on to the whole document now? Well, the person might say, well, it's the document, we'll just, you know, it's attribution, share alike. But now I'm sitting here saying, well, now you've just allowed somebody to sell my image. All you did is put it in a Word document, and now people are selling it. That's not what I had in mind. Well, but yeah, but your picture means that people can't sell my Word document anymore. That's not what I had in mind. You see what I mean? There's the problem when you take resources with different licenses, even open licenses, and mix them, you end up with incompatible licenses. That's what this chart represents, is the set of incompatible licenses. Now, my answer to this is don't mix them. I mean, to me, it seems like a really obvious thing, right? But it does change the way people have thought about educational publishing, because typically what you do is you take everything together and smoosh it into a course package or something like that. And you take that course package, zip it up, send it out a complete unit, a textbook, a workbook, a simulation, whatever. You notice the connectivism course that I presented at the start, we haven't done that. We left everything sitting right where it was. We haven't joined anything. Everything has its own license, and that license applies to the resource where it's sitting, and then people move stuff around as they will, and they don't join it, they just put it beside each other. Does that make sense? So, anyhow. This is more on that, so I'll just skip along. I want to take some time now, and this may be familiar stuff to some of you, and Alan Levine knows it by heart, but I want to survey some of the major open courseware or open educational content initiatives. The biggie, and you've already seen an example of this from this morning, is the MIT the MIT Open Courseware Initiative. It's neither the first nor the largest, but it's MIT, so it's received the most publicity. It's very widely used. The resources are very good, and what can I say? If you want university-level resources, MIT is a good place to go and browse around. It's interesting the approach that they've taken. And they were very explicit when they launched this. They said, open courseware is not an MIT education, which assuredly it's not, because an MIT education is sitting in the room with, really famous people like Seymour Papert or whomever, and talking with other MIT people, or at least people who can afford to pay the tuition to go to MIT. That's what an MIT education is, right? And so what happens is MIT OpenCourseWare becomes a marketing tool for an MIT education. And that's how you can justify the spending, and it costs them a lot of money to mount that OpenCourseWare. Other initiatives. OpenCourseWare Consortium is a network of universities who have adopted the MIT OpenCourseWare model and continued on from there. And so again, like MIT, they're taking all of their resources, their curricular material, sometimes audio or video of the lectures, simulations, applications, etc., and mounting these online. There are OpenCourseWare Consortium members from around the world. And it's worth noting, and people have noted, that Canada is very unfortunately underrepresented in these circles. We have one institution doing this. Connections is an interesting site. It's hosted by Rice University. And what Connections is a service whereby anybody can log on and create their own course and make that course available as an open educational resource. And so what you find when you go to Connections is a whole bunch of courses that are open that people have created in this way. They're very interesting about Connections because there's a bunch of software and applications underlying that, which are also at various stages of being open sourced, that support that sort of initiative. Open Educational Resource Commons is another one, a single point of access for people to look at, browse, obtain, etc., open educational resources. Image issues or?
No, just a connection you made from something you said.
Oh, okay.
Open versus private.
It's not open.
Yeah. Ah.
Thank you.
Yep, no problem. It's funny. It's funny because I don't know whether you're reacting to the talk or to the Illuminate, right? It's all connected, yeah. And I'm also aware of the time because we started late. I'm sort of, anyhow. Open Content Alliance, again, similar sort of thing. Related, Internet Archive and Our Media. Our Media is a site that I had a hand in building back in prehistory, 3 or 4 years ago. Internet Archive is Brewster Cowley's site. He's basically collecting anything and everything and storing it in one really huge database. And if you ever wonder what a website looked like in 1998, go to a resource called the Wayback Machine, Wayback. And he's recorded snapshots of these sites starting I think it's 96 or 97. I know it doesn't go all the way back because my first website, sadly, is not captured by this. And I've lost it. I know exactly what it looks like, but now nobody else will. But it does go back quite a ways. Open Learn is an initiative from the Open University in Great Britain. It's different from the other initiatives in that it doesn't simply make course resources available, it makes entire full courses available. And these are the courses that Open University offers as part of its regular academic program. I can spend the entire session talking about Open Learn, right? Intuit is another British service, and basically it mixes curation or hand selection with open educational resources, and what they do basically is they have curators collect these resources on various subjects and make them available on this site. Globe is what is called a federation or a content federation, composed of Ariadne, which is a European content site, EDNA, Education Network Australia, LoreNet, which is here in Ontario, Merlo, which is a consortium of open educational resources in the States, and Nine, which I don't know, Japan? It's probably Japan. Anyhow, these are content federations in their own right. Each one of these has a large repository of open educational materials, and Globe is a search engine that allows you to search all of those repositories through a single interface. It's called a federated search because basically what it does, when you search Globe, Globe will turn around and search each one of those in turn and then return you the results. So it's kind of like your one search propagates out into that federation. Let me talk briefly, very briefly, about the funders, because, you know, all of this doesn't come free. And there have been some large players in the world of open educational resources, and at the very least, they deserve credit. And minimally, they deserve mention. Because creating content is just the beginning. You know, anybody can create content, but then there are the considerations, the mounting, the hosting, the community around the content, the structures, etc., to putting open educational resources online. So it's important to talk about this. One major institution that has been funding open educational resources is the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. They are the people, for example, behind MIC's OpenCourseWare. They put a lot of money into that. They put a lot of money into some of the work that David Wiley did at Utah State University and many, many other projects. UNESCO is another major investor in open educational resources, and when I show you resources later on in this talk, you'll see a number of studies and reports from UNESCO on the subject. Whoops. Oh no, it's silly me. Right. Commonwealth of Learning, which I believe is still based in British Columbia, is also the funder of a number of open education initiatives, primarily directed, of course, at the Commonwealth, although I find that the people who are actually working in these initiatives find ways of reaching out beyond the Commonwealth, which I think is a good thing. Now, the creation of open educational resources, we typically think of it as somebody takes a pile of money, funds the creation of these resources, funds the mounting of a website or a service online, and that's it. But what has happened is that in the world of open educational resources, a variety of funding mechanisms have developed, and these different mechanisms create different types of open educational resources. One model that has been tried and was really successful up until the stock market crash was the endowment model, or endowment model, depending on where you're from. The Stanford Encyclopedia, which is one of my favorite resources, is funded that way, for example. And basically, they take a large pile of seed capital, invest that, and then use the interest on that to fund the resource. And the theory here is, once you've got that seed capital, then the resource is self-perpetuating. And this works so long as there isn't a stock market crash. If there is a stock market crash, then your seed capital isn't really generating much in the way of interest, and all of a sudden you have a funding crisis. But in normal times, it works really well. Another model is the membership model, and there are various examples of this. Sakai, which is a open source learning management system, is based on the membership model. Merlot, which I mentioned earlier, same sort of thing, Open Courseware Consortium. And basically the way this works is you get a bunch of institutions, typically all of which have money, and you get them to contribute a certain amount to create this consortium. So for example, in Merlot, each institution would pay something like $15,000. You get 40 or so institutions together, $15,000 to an individual college or university isn't a huge pile of money, but you can generate a pretty substantial operating budget out of a consortium of 30 or 40 or whatever institutions. So, yeah, I don't know what else to say about that. It works really well as long as your members have money. If your members don't have money, if they're caught in a budget crunch, then again, you may be budget crunched as well. A variant on this is to sell individual memberships, and there are some organizations that do that, although none of these do. Donations model is a very popular one, and is used by the less, I don't want to say less organized, because that's not right, but the less institutional of these programs. Wikipedia is funded through a donations model. Apache, the Apache Foundation, which of course makes the free and open source Apache web server, which is the major web server used on the internet, that is also run through a donations model. A conversion model you see quite a bit, especially in our space, where they give you something for free, but usually that something is a limited version of what they ultimately want you to get, and what they will do is charge you money for that thing that you are getting for free. A lot of software works that way. NoteTab, which is a Windows application I use a lot. I use NoteTab Lite, which is a free version. You can get the professional version. Flickr is a classic example. Flickr is a photo hosting site. You can buy Flickr Pro, and in fact I do, because it costs me like $25 a year. It's not that expensive. And what the Pro version buys you is unlimited uploading, and well, mostly that's what it buys you, is unlimited uploading. And I take so many photos that that's what I do. Contributor pay is common in the world of academic journals. Academic journals used to be published entirely commercially, and the publishers of these journals were so good, not only did they get the subscribers to pay, they also got the contributors to pay. And you would actually have to pay publishing fees in order to publish in these academic journals that they would turn around and sell. So what the open journals did is they took the subscription part off of this, and now they simply have a model where the contributor pays the cost of creating the article and hosting it indefinitely, and then they make the entire resource available for free. Some of the free and open source, like the Public Library of Science is a free journal. Some of the commercial publishers are adopting this as well. There's I think it's Emerald Journals has an initiative, and I believe Elsevier also has an initiative, whereby if you pay, or if you have your funder pay, which is what they really want, then they will make your journal article available as an open access article. Sponsorship model is very common. Where you'll have a commercial company sponsor some sort of free educational outreach. Apple, Microsoft, Adobe, they're all involved in some sort of sponsorship model or another, usually in return for some benefit to the sponsor. The institutional model is one we know well, where the institution, whether it be MIT, whether it be the Open University, etc., simply says as part of its mandate, part of the mandate is to provide open educational materials. That's in large part how my work gets to be open. I work for the Government of Canada, the National Research Council, and at least in my little corner of the NRC world, I consider it part of my institutional mandate to make my materials available openly to Canadians. And in fact, there is an NRC initiative that's making all NRC materials free and openly available to the public, which I think is a good thing. And so you can even confuse that, although you probably shouldn't, with the government funding model. That's how that park in Sackville got created, right? It was a government funding model. And the government funds, typically it's managed by some sort of arm's length board, but not always. And it's intended to serve government objectives, one of which is to foster learning and creativity, etc., in the population. There are various initiatives. Canada SchoolNet, if you're not familiar with that, and in particular the Media Awareness Network, is a significant resource out there, and that's produced here in Canada. Oh, I have 3 minutes and 28 slides. So I'm not even going to try to finish those. I think that would be really ridiculous. So what I'm going to do is wrap up at this point and help the conference stay on schedule. These slides will be available on my website today. So you don't need to worry about it. The remainder of the presentation does talk more about different ways of organizing open educational resources. What I want to say is this, and this is where the rest of the presentation takes us. We have this idea, because of where we were born and how we were brought up, that resources, and educational resources especially, are produced by professionals, produced by publishers. Carefully, my voice is telling me time to stop. Carefully vetted, etc. More and more, as we look at what is actually happening on the internet, the huge resource collections on YouTube, on Flickr, the Creative Commons license stuff that you can find on Google or Yahoo, we find that it's not the professionals that are creating these resources, but it's everyday people. And we find that these everyday people are doing a bang-up job presenting these resources, creating and presenting these resources. And when we're looking for a sustainable model for funding, creating, hosting open educational materials, it makes more sense to look toward the community of users of these resources. In the first instance, students, but in the second instance, the population as a whole. When these resources are thought of as community property, much in the way that Marsh is thought of as community property, it becomes the responsibility of the community as a whole to maintain them. And when that happens, the cost basically diminishes to being negligible. Each person in the community that's interested contributes a small part, and that makes for a very large resource. There's a lot more I could say about that in the 15 minutes that I don't have, so I'll end it on that note. But keeping in mind that this stuff about open educational resources creates an infrastructure that we will use when I begin to talk about the second part of this presentation this afternoon. So my voice won't let me continue further, so I'm going to thank you and finish on time. Okay, so for those of you who are online, there aren't any questions. People are kind of packing up and heading out here. This is the scheduled end of the session. So, and it looks like a pretty good and vigorous discussion happened in there. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn off my microphone here and so on. I've got the other presentation happening this afternoon. Check today's daily and... we hope to start closer to the on-time start time this afternoon. Thanks, everybody, for showing up. And thanks, George, for hosting. And thanks, Alan, who's not even on there anymore, for uploading the slides. Talk to you all later.